Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Friday evening of Thin Air 2007. I'm so glad you could join us tonight. My name is Charlene Deal, and I'm the director of this crazy effort called the Winnipeg International Writers Festival, and I'm proud to say that I'm still standing on Friday night. Now, tomorrow night, no promises, but you might want to come back and check it out, see if I'm still upright. And if I, I'm still upright, that's all I'll say. To start this evening, as I always do, I'll ask you to take 1 second and turn off those cell phones. Actually, get them out and look at them. Right? Just get it out. Don't think, oh, yeah, I think I put it on vibrate. Does it really turn it off? Because we are recording all of these evenings for future posting on our website, winnipegwords.com. Can you say winnipegwords.com? Yeah, see, you can. Very good. You're all warmed up for a Friday night. So once all the cell phones are turned off, then a big part of me just relaxes, and I know I can just listen to these great words and not be subject to fits of rage about weird little interruptions that are these little electronic noises that just don't belong here. Amongst all the many kinds of support that we get every year, we have a series of sponsors who help to underwrite the costs of these evening main stages. And tonight's sponsor is the Free Press. Take a second to welcome or thank them as well, please. Now, the thing I hate about having an event like this recorded is that, like, that flub there, like, that's going to be saved for all time. So you might actually want to go visit the website and just, get ready for it and then have a little laugh. I can handle it. I'm strong enough to handle it. Tonight's show is called Encounters. When I'm reading and reading and reading and reading over the months prior to this kind of a big shindig, I'm kind of watching certain ideas that emerge over and over again in the broad range of writing that comes across my desk. Because, of course, the publishing houses don't send me things around certain kinds of thematic ideas or kind of notions that might resurface. They don't know. They're just looking at the stuff that's been submitted to them and that they think is excellent and interesting and fits their mandate. But when I read across a lot of different writers, across a lot of different publishers, I see these curious patterns emerge, which gives me a chance to see the kinds of things that are of interest to the thinkers in our contemporary culture. And it's often similar things that happen in different art forms, too. There's certain ideas that seem to surface at certain times. And this year I was really struck by the number of people who were writing about these very curious interactions between people of very different natures or qualities or cultural backgrounds or philosophical positionings. And I began to see how various of these writers might be speaking to one another in my own head, and thought that I, as always, have this great good fortune of being able to gather specific people in one place at one time. And I've been thinking a lot about these kind of cultural or ideological collisions as I was putting together this show, and thinking about the idea of encounter as being kind of two different things which might, or three or four or five, which might come into proximity in some way or other. And I like the idea of encounter rather than collision, because encounter suggests that there's some kind of connection between even very disparate positions, and that neither party would emerge in quite the same way at the other side of that kind of moment of proximity. So I've gathered tonight's readers all together tonight because they all demonstrate in various ways that moment of encounter, or those large moments of encounter, sometimes large cultural moments of encounter. And as I was gathering the whole week together, I realized this is also the night when we would make public marking of the people who are not able to, who we are not able to encounter because they are unable to speak their minds freely. And so this is the night when we mark the pen empty chair program. So you'll notice that there is a photograph of a writer who is unable to be with us because he has been imprisoned in Uzbekistan since sometime in the 1990s. His name is Mamadali Makhmudov, and there's a whole story about him in our lobby, and the petition has been out there all week, but I'd encourage you to take a minute to have a look at that. And we will leave him lit all night as a way of us making some notice that some people are not able to speak about the encounters that they understand and that should be available to all of us. PEN Canada, if you don't know about them, are a really powerful advocacy group and part of an international advocacy group that speaks on behalf of writers that are silenced in various ways. So tonight's, I should also say that one of the writers that I was hoping to have on this evening, Marie-Claire Blais, is unable to come. So if you didn't see that notice on our website and have come expressly to hear Marie-Claire, I'm very sorry about that, but I promise you'll still have a great evening because there are many other very fine voices here tonight. I would like to begin by introducing you to Linda Leith, who is a fiction and nonfiction writer who comes to us from Montreal, where she, with all the poise in the world and apparently without ever even losing her breath, runs the Blue Met Literary Festival. So I bow down before her because I came blasting into the green room all out of breath and almost at the last second, and there she sat looking like nothing had ever ruffled her feathers in a million years. And besides doing that, she also writes very beautiful novels, and she has a brand new one for us tonight. It's actually brand new, just a couple of days old, called The Desert Lake. Please welcome Linda Leith.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here in Winnipeg, and I would like to begin by thanking Charlene and her team for this marvelous festival, and of course for including me. The Desert Lake is a novel set in China, and the encounters that I suppose I'm going to be talking about and reading about are encounters with Chinese and with the Chinese language. And I suppose also with the self, because whenever you travel, that's what you really meet. I began this novel in the summer of 1997, 10 years ago. It took me a long time, but then I have been doing a few other things. At the time, 10 years ago, I was part of a Canadian literary delegation to China. I was on the executive of the Writers Union of Canada, and there was a group of writers that was flew to Beijing, and then we traveled to Lanzhou, which is a city in the province of Gansu, and then we took a vacation afterwards, and we went to Dunhuang, which is an incredible place in the desert, the Taklimakan Desert in northwestern China. And it was when I was there that I took notes about some of the extraordinary places that I was visiting. So this novel follows a character called Barbara and some other writers and publishers, a literary delegation of Canadians traveling across China. My characters are going to the same places that I went to. It's actually pretty unlikely that they would have found themselves there if I had not been there first. The settings and descriptions, in other words, are real, and the story is the story of Barbara and her and four other characters. It's a story of making your way through difficulties, and it's also a story about writing. Now, Barbara is a Montrealer. She's 31. She writes a relationships column. And her column is called Mad About Men. And it's also the title, that is also the title of her book. She's just published about a year earlier, before this book opens, she has published her first book, which is a book of her columns. And it has sold very well, thanks to her agent. Now, her agent is a character in the novel because he's the man, his name is Josh, who's having, and they are having a relationship. The trouble is that he lives in Los Angeles and she lives in Montreal. So when it is suggested that she go on this delegation to China, she is willing to go on condition that Josh go too, because she'd like to make sure that this is in fact going to be a relationship that will last. Josh, true love, China. These were the key words. Barbara did not know how to fit them together. She was missing articles, prepositions, conjunctions, verbs, moods, tenses. She didn't know how to turn these words into a story. She didn't even know how to turn them into a sentence. All she had for now were these few words, his name, her heart's desire, a destination. That's from the very beginning of the novel, when Barbara's on her way to Beijing with Harry and Joey. Joey's a novelist. Josh was supposed to have landed ahead of them in Beijing, and the problem is that he is not there when they arrive at the hotel, and there's no message from him either. Barbara tries calling everyone she knows who might know what had happened to Josh. There's no answer at any of the telephone numbers that she calls. She leaves messages, her voice duller with each call. His colleague, she said finally, Charlotte, she's the one handling many of his clients, including Barbara herself. Charlotte was her agent now. Josh did the new business, and that was sort of okay. Charlotte was pleasant, businesslike. Was it better that Charlotte was her agent? Was it worse? Barbara didn't know. She had never known what to make of the fact that Josh was her agent, and now she didn't know what to make of the fact that he was not. Charlotte, she was there. Yes? It's Barbara. I'm sorry to be calling you at this hour, but this is an emergency. I need to find Josh, and he's not at any of the usual numbers. We were supposed to meet this afternoon in China, and he hasn't shown up, so I'm calling to find out what on earth has happened. I've been so worried. Charlotte was a few years older than Barbara, attractive enough in a big-toothed American way. Where were you going to meet him? She asked. China. Is that a restaurant? That really is what she said. The People's Republic of China, Charlotte, Barbara said, keeping her voice calm. No, it's not a restaurant. Harry laughed, hearing this. Charlotte clearly had no idea that Josh was supposed to be in China, and Charlotte would have known. We were supposed to meet this afternoon. Okay. Charlotte was noncommittal. I'm calling you from Beijing, Charlotte, Barbara said. The capital of China, she added, just in case she still didn't get it. That's where I am now. Josh was supposed to arrive on United Airlines flight 4456 and meet me at the Beijing Airport Hilton. She paused, thinking Charlotte would have some news for her, but Charlotte said nothing. There's no sign of him, Charlotte. Has something happened? Is he okay? Barbara listened to what Charlotte had to say and then said thank you. She hung up, looked at Harry. Josh is okay. That's the good news. Charlotte says he drove out to his cabin this morning, which I guess means yesterday. Barbara hesitated. Whatever. She's not sure how long he'll be there. There's no phone at the cabin, and his cell phone doesn't work in the mountains. Barbara didn't know where the cabin was. She had never been there. If she were to fly to L.A. tomorrow, she would not know where to find him. The worst thing was that she had been worrying about him for no reason. He was fine. Was that the worst thing? No. That was the best thing. It was the best thing and the worst thing. My head is splitting, Barbara said, suddenly furious with Josh. All that unnecessary worry now turned against him. So he was okay. So then what happened? What the hell was going on? Barbara decides to continue on her journey with the others. They're joined by Fu. Fu's an old friend of Joey's, and she's now the head of the Chinese Publishers Association, and she studied in East Germany so that she speaks English with a German accent. Together, these people travel to Lanzhou participate in a conference on Canadian literature. Barbara has given up on Josh and focuses on taking notes on her surroundings, on writing. Writing is what will get her through this. On the very last night in Lanzhou, before they head further into the desert, there's a banquet hosted by the university, the conversation turns to Chinese poetry. And Fu, who in the past days of traveling together has fallen in love with Harry, starts drawing on the paper tablecloth to try to explain how Chinese poetry works and how it differs from poetry written in English or indeed in other languages. Great Chinese poets are able to express more with the use of just a few characters than is possible in other languages. This is actually the bookmark from the novel, which actually I'll be talking about. I'm not sure if you can actually see some of the characters on it. But this is a line from the poet Wang Wei, in which he's describing a hibiscus beginning to blossom. This, the first character, is Branch. And she wrote the English word underneath the character. This is end. Together we have hibiscus. And here we have another character meaning flowers or blooms. So we translate the line, at the end of the branch, the hibiscus flowers. There are other levels too. The handsome student's remark drew the attention of everyone at the table to the characters Fu had drawn on the table. Ja, das ist korrekt, Fu smiled. She pointed at the five characters in succession. Even if you don't know how to read the characters, you must notice the visual aspect to the line. I don't know what you mean, Barbara said. Look at them one by one. The first is the simplest, like a bare tree. Here, in the second one, something is added to the end of the branch. Next, a bud breaks out. Then, in the fourth character, the bud bursts open. And finally, in this final last character, we have a flower in bloom. I see, Harry said. He was talking to Fu, not to Barbara. She herself could see how the bud broke out and then bloomed. The characters tell a visual story that agrees with their meaning as words. Yes, so that's part of it, Wang said, but there's more. The next part is harder to see unless you have some background in the language. But look at this character here. He pointed to the third character, singling out just the lower elements. This element here, on its own, is the ideogram of a man, of a person. A Chinese reader would know that the third and fourth characters together mean hibiscus, but they would also notice that a person has entered the picture, and that from this point onwards, the tree is inhabited by the presence of a human being. The fourth character, Fu went on, outlining the lower element there too, contains face, which includes the element mouth. And the fifth character contains the element transformation or metamorphosis, the idea of a person, of the poet himself being transformed in the process of creating his poem. So, with just these five characters, the poet has expressed three different meanings simultaneously. Three? Joey asked. The whole table was focused on Fu and the sheet of paper in front of her. Ja. Fu looked up and stuck her thumb into the air. One, the literal description of a hibiscus branch blooming. Her index finger followed. Two, the visual depiction of flowering. And now her middle finger. Three, the writer's own transformation in the process of writing. A poem should not mean, but be. Isn't that what Ezra Pound said? Harry had been watching Fu closely and seemed to have followed all this without difficulty. Barbara had known he had an interest in poetry. Did he have an interest in Fu as well? Barbara hoped so, for his sake and for Fu's. She herself was feeling very alone. It's a lot easier to see how that works with Chinese poetry than with poetry in English, although Pound did what he could, of course. Joey nodded. She understood, too. Unfathomable was the word Barbara had thought of when she was thinking about China before they left Montreal. It was no consolation to have been right. She felt small and helpless, like a child on the edge of the ocean. Swimming it was entirely out of the question. She would perish long before she could cross it. But even if by some miracle she succeeded in reaching the far shore, she would have had only marginal success, for both the breadth of the ocean and its great depths would remain beyond her forever. The banquet was over. Despite an excess of courtesy and warmth during the meal itself, everyone stood up the minute they had finished eating, and before Barbara knew it, the dignitaries had disappeared without a word, Wang had gone on his way, and the others were all being shepherded to a dance for some of the English students. Thank you very much.
That's Linda Leith. Thank you, Linda. The second reader for the first half is a writer who is just presenting to the world his very first novel, and I feel particularly happy because I got to see this novel and it was still a manuscript. Apparently it's changed a bit since then, but I was just mesmerized by it in the first five pages. It's called Sukuyan, and the writer is David Cherryandy, and this book has just hit the long list for the Giller. Please welcome David Cherryandy.
Thank you, Charlene, and I want to thank everyone involved in the Thin Air Festival. This is an extraordinary festival, and I feel very honored to be part of it, especially as a very new writer. I also feel honored by the attention I'm receiving right now, so thank you. Thank you all. My novel, Sukuyan, is essentially about a mother with dementia. In fact, she has presenile dementia, so she's started to exhibit signs of forgetting relatively early in her life. The relationship between that mother and her son, who is witnessing the evolution or devolution of this condition. It's set in Canada of today, but it looks back to Trinidad during the Second World War. And I guess the encounter that it offers is that encounter with the specters of the elsewhere past. Sukuyant is a vampire-like figure in Caribbean folklore, and in this novel, it represents precisely that the specters of the past. I'll just read from the first chapter. And I'll skip around a bit so I can keep this as short as possible. Long ago, she began to forget. It started with ordinary things, shopping lists and recipes, bus change and savings cards, pens for jotting down those household tasks that always managed to slip away. But then, Mother began to forget in far more creative ways. She began to forget names and places, goals and meanings. She began to forget the laws of language and the routes to salvation and the proper things to do with one's body. She began to excuse herself from the world we knew. My brother and I were the first to notice. We were young children when it started and naturally alert for the smallest signs of adult weakness. When Mother wasn't looking, we'd climb up to the cupboards and eat peanut butter and corn syrup, lime pickle and molasses. Also the most perverse delicacy we could then imagine, Crisco shortening, spooning up the white sludge with our fingers and leaving greasy prints on the cupboard doors and walls and doorknobs. Mother couldn't understand why she never remembered to replenish her cooking goods, why she would never remember to give the home a good all-round scrubbing. We were never caught. Of course, Mother was minding five or six other children in those early days. Her wits were already strained to the limit. Friday evenings, the children's parents would come and apologize for the days when they were forced to work overtime at their offices without proper warning. They would smile apologetically when handing Mother envelopes. But what messages were these people passing her, really? What kind of people envelope their words? This was the earliest stage of Mother's condition, and she had already learned to conceal her confusion from others and trust that in time things would become clear. She would wave the children's parents goodbye and open the envelopes carefully with a knife, sorting through the small numbers of fives and tens. Dirty numbers, meaning new safety boots for her husband and belts for her boys, and of course more endlessly dwindling cooking goods. Money was too precious a meaning to forget. But soon there came the times when Mother hurriedly dressed one boy in his snowmobile suit and ushered him to his parents waiting outside, only then to remember too late that these parents had a girl, that girl with the haunting glass marble eyes and the brilliant golden hair, or brown. She would have had brown hair, Mother reminded herself. Mother would laughingly explain to the parents just how difficult it was to tell the difference between boys and girls these days. Just look at the rock stars, she would say. Nanny, stand up. But her jokes fell flat, and Mother steadily lost her jobs. She was supposed to be minding children, after all. She was living at the edge of the bluffs, near an active railway. Metal monsters in the night, dirty numbers and greasy doorknobs. This was our belonging. Memory was a carpet stain that no one would confess to. History was a television set left on all night. The car chases and gunfights sponsored by oil companies. the anthems at the end of broadcast days. Then, a crisis in something called the economy. Father was laid off at the factory, but then later rehired as a temp after two agonizing weeks. The work was erratic. The factory wouldn't need him for weeks on end, but then, faced with a last-minute order to fill, it would suddenly call upon him round the clock. Father became a maniac in those days, a blur of energy bursting through the front door to bolt cold dal and rice from Tupperware in the fridge, frantic nap, bathroom, frantic nap, chugging lukewarm cups of instant coffee, then back out to catch another shift, a toppled milk carton in his wake, pattering white upon the floor. Mother's jokes continued to fall flat. One afternoon, Father took his first long chug from his coffee mug before running to the kitchen sink to retch endlessly, waving away our concerns as another belt of sickness took him. Mother had accidentally filled the sugar bowl with salt, and Father had unknowingly made himself a briny pickle of a coffee. All four of us were in the kitchen that day, three sitting quietly until Father's spasms at the sink had passed. Such an awesome sight, his big shoulders heaving up. It was my brother who finally broke the silence. "It's April Fool's Day, right, Mother? What you say, child? You know, April Fool's Day, when people do jokes and no one suspects because no one remembers what day it is anyway." "Yes," said Mother. "You's right, child. It certainly is that day. Merry April Fool's Day, Roger." "You know, girls," said Father, finding his breath, 30 years, and I still don't know how to celebrate in this country." Mother staggered into forgetfulness. She wandered the streets of our neighborhood in upturned people's garbage bins, looking for the good things these wasteful people just throw away. She borrowed things from corner stores and people's garages, failing to recall the concept of private property. Relying on some deeply Caribbean hunch, she kicked any dog that approached her, once sending a miniature poodle spinning around its owner like a tetherball. She became easy prey for the most unimaginative of crank callers, and she'd answer and listen for long moments before calling out for us to catch the refrigerator, since it running, her hand cupping the wrong end of the phone for privacy. Left alone at home, she'd forget where the washroom was and would be forced to wait for agonizing hours until someone came home to show her. Later, she'd see no reason why she should wait, and we began to notice that certain potted plants smelled of urine. We tried to stop her from accomplishing many household tasks, like washing clothes, but we didn't always succeed. She performed experiments with bleach and vinegar on our shirts and jeans, and we ended up wearing the acid wash look in entirely the wrong year for us to be considered fashionable. One afternoon, she left a pot of milk on the stove that soon bubbled over and filled the air with acrid smoke. Returning from school, I smelled the calamity and ran up the stairs to a scene of confusion and teary eyes, with Mother running around the house trying to find and rescue a three-year-old child from the imagined fire. When she crashed into me, she screamed not with relief, but with outrage. How could I be a teenager already? "Tell me, how? How?" Always her questions. "How old are you?" 12 and a half. "How old are you?" 13 next week. "What's your name?" "Mother, I'm scared sometimes, Mother." "Don't be stupid, child. I know what your name is. I just wanting you to say it properly." "Caramba, child. Just say it properly for me now and stop setting up your face like some baby." The week I turned 14, Father took us to an all-you-can-eat buffet. He was uncharacteristically happy. He'd voted for the winning Conservative Party in the past election, and he felt that he had thus contributed in some small way to the strengthening economy that the newspapers were describing. There'd surely be the chance for full-time work at the factory or somewhere else very soon. My brother was also happy. He had attended a poetry reading in the city, and some old guy in khakis had approached him and urged him to keep writing and to begin submitting his work to magazines. My brother explained to us that he wasn't ready to show his stuff to anyone just yet, but he added that he was happy to know that there were people out there, people who cared about these things. Father said a quiet grace and then ordered my 16-year-old brother a beer to my amazement and secret jealousy. Jealousy. And you see it on the page, it's sometimes very different. I think I should know that word, though, should I not? I wrote it. We then laughingly set out on what my brother called our hunting operations, with the goal of happily confirming beyond any doubt what others in the restaurant might have already suspected about the appetites of dark-skinned people. We were sitting down with plates piled high when we noticed Mother had disappeared. We split up and searched everywhere. We went to the ladies' washroom and called into it and asked women who looked at us suspiciously to please check the stalls. We angered a raccoon while checking dumpsters behind the restaurant. We asked people table by table if they saw someone leave. A black woman, excuse me, but would you have by any chance have noticed a black woman? Finally, the manager pushed open the door and found Mother in the staff dressing room, sitting in the corner. Her hands were clasped around her knees and her long pleated skirt fanned out neatly on the floor. Her head was down, but we could see that her makeup was streaked. I waited for my brother to say something reassuring, something appropriate, but he was quiet. I waited for Father to act, but he remained quiet and still, though he clenched and unclenched his thick fingers. I called to Mother, but she didn't answer. I lowered myself beside her. I sat there reading the soap bucket stains on the floor with her for a few moments, a zag like a W, an unclosed O. I took her hand in mine. Mother raised her head and looked at me. It took a while, but then she smiled. We all returned to our table and quietly ate the food, now cold and gelid, on our plates. We skipped the dessert bar with the voluptuous strawberry tarts that we had earlier noticed. Mother sat beside me on the bus ride home, and at one point she cupped her hand on top of my own. I knew it, she whispered to me, just for me to hear. I knew that you would never leave me. But Mother wasn't simply forgetting. She might be standing near the kitchen window, looking out over the rippled granite of the waters, when a word would slip from her mind and pronounce itself upon her lips. Carenage, she might say, almost surprised that she had done so. We was moved by the soldiers to an old village named Carenage, named after the Spanish ships that anchored there long ago to get careen. Clean up from barnacles, yes? Free up from their weight and make smooth again after the trip from Africa. There was an old woman who did know, a woman with long memory and the proper names of things. We was moved, but there was a boy who go get sick with the cough. He would a dead, but she tell us what to make, a tea of shadow benny, another bush. We all laugh in relief as he spooned the stuff to his lips. He bit a face and the flutter of his hands trying to push the taste away. He first sign of fight in days. Kakashat, she said another time, for sugars and blood pressures and growths. Zuti, you wouldn't know it unless you had the wisdom. It stings when you touch it, but in a tea it could save your life when your body won't give up its water. Mother never deliberately explained to me her past, but I learned anyway of Lagahus and Duons and other specters of long ago meaning. Sukuya, Mother said aloud to herself one day. I saw one in the morning, a morning thick with burnt light. I walking a narrow path of dirt, you see, my ankles painted cool by the wet grasses. Her voice trailed off. She noticed me sitting beside her. You know what a sukuyant is, child? Isn't she an evil spirit? Someone who sucks your blood at night? Yes, Mother answered after a pause, really only the shortest pause. Yes, child, you is absolutely correct. I'll explain it this way. During our lives, we struggle to forget. And it's foolish to assume that forgetting is altogether a bad thing. Memory is a bruise still tender. History is a rusted pile of blades and manacles, and forgetting can sometimes be the most creative and life-sustaining thing that we can ever hope to accomplish. The problem happens when we become too good at forgetting, when we somehow forget to forget, and we blunder into circumstances that we consciously should have avoided. This is how we awaken to stories buried deep within our sleeping selves or trafficked quietly through the touch of others. This is how we're shaken by vague scents and tastes, how we're stolen by an obscure word, an undertow dragging us back and down and away. One more short passage. Our last dinner together as a family. We still had dinner together, though Mother had become less interested in eating. Father said a prayer, thanking the Lord for the strength he gives to all who suffer, the protection he gives from the spirits of darkness. Mother was fine for a while, but then she started drifting. She was using the serving spoon to poke at the obscene dish of beef and macaroni that Father had poured to us from a can when she stopped to touch the back of her head, and afterwards, the thin scar at her cheek. She traced the lacy roughness as if discovering it for the first time. a braille, it told a story. Shagaramas, she explained. She lost she skin at the military base in Shagaramas. She wore a dress of fire before it go ruin her. I wore a hat of orange light, a sheet of peonies on my head and neck. I turn in to help and undo it all, but I trip up, my chin busting up against something sharp, darkness washing me all over. When I awake, I back at her home in Carinage. They call the old woman, and she here now reaching up into the tall parts of the house, reaching and stretching like she appealing to the creatures of corners and ceilings. She gathering cobwebs, you see. I remember that she put a pillow for my head, and that she tell me lie face up. I remember the numbness at the back of my head, and the cobwebs falling light like a spell upon me, the blood no longer itching down my neck. And I remember the one they laid beside me, like a mother. She head completely tied up in white as gauze. She muffled sounds not quite like crying. Silence around the table. Father was mechanically forking food to his mouth, spooning on more and more hot sauce and cooling his tongue with short intakes of breath. My brother didn't look up either and seemed preoccupied with the task of arranging the macaroni on his plate into a series of commas without words. Only the Great Lake spoke its piece, its wash and roll and wash. Thank you.
That's David Cherryandy and a very beautiful book. The third reader for the first half is hardly needs to be introduced here, I think. She's one of the new forces on the local writing scene. Her new book, I'm sorry about this, Brenda. I actually have to check my, Where the Rocks Say My Name. This is funny because earlier Armin said it and I thought, yeah, I've been looking at that book and looking at that book. It's an absolutely beautiful book. She's been at the Red River College a few times this week talking about writing. Some of you may have seen her there. She was up on the list for two different awards this spring in the Manitoba Publishing and Writing Awards, and she's a real force to be reckoned with. Please welcome Brenda Hasiak.
I, of course, want to say thank you for having me here, the local girl in such intimidating company. So I feel very honored. I'm basically going to read from the prologue to the book, where we find three young people in a pickup truck. They're on their way. They're on their way home after a kind of lazy day at the lake, and it's the kind of spot, a kind of deserted and pristine place that you can still find in some places in Manitoba. Rena was in the front seat with her bare feet propped up against the dashboard. She was leaning forward and trying to paint her toenails cranberry crush, and Toby, who was driving, rested one hand on the soft curve at the bottom of her neck. Allie sat in the cramped back cab, watching Toby's thumb slowly move over Rena's vertebrae like he was strumming a ballad on a guitar. For the last 10 minutes, Rena had been teasing Toby about the one thing he held strong opinions about. The windows were open, and she spoke loudly over the rush of wind. "But why can't you do something, Toby? Maybe the people, they actually like to watch." Toby was 19, exactly 13 months older than Allie, who told him this made them the same age since girls mature faster. They'd both lived in this place of hot and cold their whole lives, on land so rocky that sewage pipes have to be enclosed in wooden boxes above ground. They took for granted the towering presence of the smelter smokestack, endlessly spewing its industry over the houses and the shops and the new hotel down by the highway and the dense forest all around. They didn't blink at bear traps in driveways. But Rena had grown up far away, across an ocean and most of a continent, where they'd been building roads and buildings almost 1,000 years before this rocky land was even on a map. This meant there were times when she had something funny to say on the tip of her tongue, and she had to let it float away, just like that, because it was in the wrong language. It meant that though she was the youngest of her friends, not quite 18, you would never have guessed it. For Rena had seen things that don't belong in anybody's childhood or anywhere else. Still, on this night, none of that seemed to matter. She was acting more drunk than she was and felt the kind of giddiness that pretty girls do when their olive skin has turned fawn-colored in the sun and they feel free to enjoy the effect they're having. When she turned to Toby, she could actually hear his longing in the way he breathed. Or, you know, a sport that maybe any of the people has even heard of. She held the nail polish brush in midair and braced herself. She knew exactly what was coming. This time, when Toby jerked the steering wheel quickly left and right, she didn't get cranberry crush all over her toes again. Instead, she painted a bright red line across his forearm. A half-ton truck flashed past, and Toby had to steady the wheel with both hands. A more skittish person might have been shaken, but for him, there was only the usual lazy contentment. With the rush of speed and wind lingering in his ears, the nail polish strangely cold against his skin, all he could do was shake his head and smile. He wasn't consciously aware of loving the wildflowers in the ditch, quickly disappearing into the blue dusk, or the presence of Allie behind and Rena beside him, or the smell of the descending dew, sweet and familiar, rushing in to mix with their sweat. He simply sensed them all at once and knew it was good. Toby couldn't even be bothered to think of a good comeback. It was as if all his life he'd instinctively known that the best way to ruin things was to think too much. Rena ran her fingers over the red line on his forearm, like she was admiring a scar. "Tell her, Allie," he said. "Tell her that the best sports are a blend of endurance and skill." Allie undid her seatbelt and leaned in between them. With the windows rolled down, their voices had been drifting out past the gravel shoulder before they could really reach her, floating over the wildflower ditch until they were lost in the growing darkness of the bush. Rena dipped the brush in the bottle and aimed toward Allie's nose. "Everybody thinks you're weird," Allie said. "The biathlon sounds like something bisexuals do." Toby threw up his hands as though he'd finally given up and wanted to end it all. "You should be a hockey player," Rena said, still fingering his scar. "What do they call it when they go down the snow on the one ski?" "Snowboarder," Allie said. "They say nobody gets the women like a snowboarder." Before Toby could defend himself, there was a small black shape in the headlights. He swerved into the opposite lane, and Rena was thrown against his shoulder. Tiny yellow eyes flashed still for a moment, bright and terrified, then disappeared into the murky dark as quickly as they'd come. As he eased into the right lane, Rena stayed where she'd landed, gripping the nail polish in one hand and resting her other hand on his chest. Allie did up her seatbelt again. "Lucky bugger," Toby said. He could still feel the adrenaline pulsing through his fingertips. Rena's damp hair smelled like apples, and it was almost more than he could stand. "You remember that time," Allie asked, "on the school bus with the ducks?" Allie leaned forward as far as she could. "What ducks?" "Don't you remember?" Toby asked. "There was this family of ducks just walking along in a line across the highway, and we could see them up front, but the driver could only swerve a bit and try to miss some." Allie rested her head back and let him lead her through the familiar routine. He was always remembering things from when they were small. "And?" "The last three in line got squished." "You remember how many got squished?" she asked. "Yeah," Toby said. "The last three or four of them got the pancake treatment." Allie shook her head and smiled to herself in the dark. "You remember how many?" "Yeah," he said. "Don't you remember?" Rena pulled away from him and hugged her long legs against her chest. "Toby, you talk about stupid things. Even the biathlon is more fun than dead ducks." Toby kept both hands on the wheel, calmer now and feeling like an idiot. The scar of nail polish had dried itchy and tight against his skin. Allie settled down into the darkness and closed her eyes. In her mind, she followed the yellow eyes past the gravel shoulder, over the wildflower ditch, and deep into the woods. Though it was totally black now, she could see herself lying there, curled up in a clearing of damp moss, having a snooze. Toby was nestled in behind her, his knees tucked inside hers. They were covered with a beach towel, but her imagination didn't seem to care whose it was, his or hers. "But do you remember that, Al?" Toby shouted above the wind. "No," she replied, "not really." So we start with only three. That evening, when a small fox was spared, only three of them were there. Adam, the failed warrior, had not yet come back. but he would soon, because this is the story of 8 weeks in the lives of four people, not quite fully grown, and the people who loved them. Just one summer is all you get. Twice the moon grew full, then thin again. Animals tended their young and began their mad scurry to fatten themselves for the hard months to come, as if for the very first time. Two calendar pages fell near the beginning of the 21st century. Fires burned, hearts broke, and then there was only one in a small northern town in the middle of a large northern country that most of the world still regards as a rather wild landscape populated by peaceful and polite, if rather boring, people. Thank you.
The fun continues in the second half with two amazing writers who both have big, sprawling, sometimes challenging novels. Both of these novels I was very excited about when I saw the catalogs come across my desk in the last few months. I've been interested in William Gibson's work for probably more than 20 years, and it's always amazing to see the way he thinks about, in the old days, how he used to think about the future, and increasingly how he thinks about the present. Neuromancer was one of those books that kind of rearranged my mind, and Spook Country, his brand new novel, is a very different kind of project, but has that same kind of slow burn, which just says that your mind is slowly being rebuilt from the inside. Please welcome William Gibson.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's been a pleasure to visit Winnipeg for the first time, and I'm really, really impressed with the Thin Air Festival. And I'm going to read you a chapter of Spook Country, my new novel. And this is a difficult book to read from because the chapters are both very short and sort of deliberately overloaded with stuff. But here we come in, my heroine Hollis Henry is being driven by Hubertus Bigend, who some of you may know from my previous novel, who's a kind of a spooky global advertising man. And he's driving her in a huge contemporary in obscenely expensive German limousine called a Maybach. And Maybach is a sort of, it's what some people call a ghost brand, because Hitler was always driven in a Maybach. And after the Second World War, the brand just sort of evaporated. But more recently, whatever entity owns Mercedes-Benz rebirthed the Maybach, and because there's a need for that sort of vehicle. Anyway, this is called Tulpa. Had that woman in the wheelchair had an IV drip stand in tow, one handing her way across the intersection, the other hand keeping the chrome-plated upright of the stand erect? Had she been legless? Hollis couldn't say, but after the skateboarder with no lower jaw, it didn't seem like that big a deal. "Your company's down here?" she asked Big End as he turned the Maybach into an alleyway that looked as though a Bradley fighting vehicle would be the wise man's ride of choice. Past the delirious frozen surge of graffiti, a sort of street fractal hokusai wave, and under a lowering lip of coiled razor wire topping chain link gates. "Yes," he said, steering onto a concrete ramp rising 15 feet as it hugged a wall that seemed to her as though it must belong to some city infinitely older than Los Angeles. Babylon, perhaps, its only graffiti cuneiform and discreet, furtive, clerkish hen scratching applied to the odd brick. The Maybach came to a temporary halt on a flat truck-length platform facing an articulated metal door. There were bulbous growths of smoked black plastic above this, pods housing cameras and perhaps other things as well. The door, decorated with a black pontilist portrait of Andre the Giant, Orwellian in scale, rose slowly, Andre's somber thyroidal gaze giving way to halogen brilliance. Big N drove forward into a hangar-like space, smaller than Bobby Chombo's empty factory, but still impressive. Half a dozen identical silver sedans were parked there in a row, beside a brand new yellow forklift and tall, tidy stacks of new gypsum wallboard. Big N stopped the car. A ball-capped guard in black uniform shorts and matching short-sleeve shirt regarded them from behind mirrored glasses. A laden, multi-compartmented black holster was strapped to his right thigh. She felt a sudden, intense desire to get out of the Maybach and acted on it. The door opened like some disturbing hybrid of bank vault and Armani evening purse. Perfectly balanced, bomb-proof solidity meeting sheer cosmetic slickness. The gritty concrete floor, blotched with crumbs of gypsum, felt comforting in contrast. The guard gestured with a remote. She heard segmented steel start to rattle down behind them. "This way, please," said Big End over the clatter of the closing door. He stepped away from the Maybach without bothering to close his door, so she left hers open as well and followed him. She looked back just as she was catching up with him and saw it sitting open, its interior a soft, mouth-like cavern of gray lambskin under the high-resolution brilliance of the garage's lighting. "We're losing the better part of the neighborhood's edge," he said, as the reclamation continued, guiding her around a 10-foot stack of drywall. "The better part?" she asked. "Majority of," he said. "I'll miss it myself. It unsettles visitors. Unsettled is good. Last week we opened a new suite of offices in Beijing. I'm not satisfied, not at all. 3 floors in a new building, really nothing we could do with them. But it's Beijing," he shrugged. "What choice do we have?" She didn't know, so said nothing. He led her up a wide flight of stairs and into what was obviously in the process of becoming a foyer. Another guard, studying CCTV windows on a panel display, ignored them. They stepped into an elevator, its every surface taped over with white-dusted layers of corrugated cardboard. Big N lifted a flap of the stuff and touched the controls. They rose 2 floors and the door opened. He gestured for her to go ahead. She stepped out onto a scuffed runway of more of the same cardboard, taped across a floor of some smooth gray product. The cardboard ran to a conference table, 6 chairs on a side. Above this, on the wall beyond, hung Anton Corbin's portrait of her, in perfect resolution on a screen perhaps 30 feet on the diagonal. "A wonderful image," Big N said, as she looked from it back to him. I've never been entirely comfortable with it, she said. Because the celebrity self is a sort of tulpa, he said. A what? A projected thought form, a term from Tibetan mysticism. The celebrity self has a life of its own. It can, under the right circumstances, indefinitely survive the death of its subject. That's what every Elvis sighting is about, literally. All of which reminded her very much of how Inchmail looked at these things, though really she believed it too. What happens, she asked him, if the celebrity self dies first? Very little, he said. That's usually the problem. But images of this caliber serve as a hedge against that. And music is the most purely atemporal of media. The past isn't dead, she said. It's not even past. Quoting Inchmail, quoting Faulkner. Would you mind changing channels on that? He gestured toward the screen. The Hook appeared in her place, the Soviet cargo helicopter photographed from below. What do you make of all this? He asked. The smile flashed like a lighthouse. There were no apparent windows in this room, and at the moment this screen was the sole source of light. You like unsettled? She asked. Yes. Then you like me, she said. I do like you, he said, and something would be very wrong if you weren't. Unsettled, I mean. She went to the conference table and ran a finger along its black surface, leaving a faint trace in gypsum dust. Is there really a magazine? She asked. Everything, said Big End, is potential. Everything, she said, is potential bullshit. Think of me as a patron, he said. Please. I don't like the sound of that, thanks, she said. In the early 1920s, Begin said, there were still some people in this country who hadn't yet heard recorded music. Not many, but a few. That's less than 100 years ago. Your career as a recording artist, making the quotes with his hands, took place toward the end of a technological window that lasted less than 100 years. A window during which consumers of recorded music lacked the means of producing that which they consumed. They could buy recordings, but they couldn't reproduce them. The curfew came in as that monopoly on the means of production was starting to erode. Prior to that monopoly, musicians were paid for performing, published and sold sheet music, or had patrons. The pop star, as we knew her, and here he bowed slightly in her direction, was actually an artifact of pre-ubiquitous media. Of what? Of a state in which mass media existed, if you will, within the world, as opposed to comprising it, he said. The light in the room changed as he said this. She raised her eyes to the screen where a metallic blue ant glyph had taken over the screen. What's in Chombo's container? She asked. It's not Chombo's container, he said. Your container, then. It's not our container, he said. Our being you and who? She asked. You, he said. It's not my container, she said. Just as I said Big End, and smiled. Whose is it, then, she asked. I don't know, he said, but I believe you might be able to find out. What's in it, she asked. We don't know that either, he said. What does Chombo have to do with it, then? Chombo, evidently, he said, has found a way to know where it is, at least periodically. So why don't you just ask him? Because it's a secret. Chombo's being paid handsomely to keep it a secret, and his personality is such, as you've noted, that he likes having a secret. Who's paying him then? That seems to be even more of a secret, he said. Do you think it might be the container's owner, she asked? Or its ultimate addressee, should it ever acquire one? I don't know, he said, but you, Hollis, are the person I've found whom Bobby is most likely to talk to. You weren't there, she said. He wasn't that glad to have Alberto bring me around. There were no suggestions of further invitations. That's where I'm convinced you're wrong, he said. When he's gotten used to the idea that you're available for more FaceTime, you may well hear from him. What have iPods got to do with it, she asked. He raised an eyebrow. Roush told me to look for iPods being used for data storage, she said. Do people still do that? Chombo, he said, periodically loads an iPod with data and sends it out of the United States. What kind of data, she asked. Music, ostensibly. We've had no way of finding out. Do you know where he sends them? San Jose, Costa Rica, so far. We have no idea where else it might go from there. Who receives it? Someone whose job is to run an expensive post office box, essentially. There's a lot of that, evidently, in San Jose. We're working on it. Have you been there? No, she said. There's quite a community of retired CIA people there, he said. DEA as well. We have someone there now trying to have a quiet look into things, though so far it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. Why are you so interested in the contents of Chombo's container, she asked. Big N removed a pale blue microfiber dust cloth from his jacket pocket, pulled a chair out on its casters and gave it a good dusting. Seat? He offered her the chair. No, thanks, she said. Go ahead. He seated himself. He looked up at her. I've learned to value anomalous phenomena, Hollis. Very peculiar things that people do, often secretly, have come to interest me in a certain way. I spend a lot of money often trying to understand those things. From them, sometimes, emerge Blue Ant's most successful efforts. Trope Slope, for instance, our viral pitchman platform, was based on pieces of anonymous footage being posted on the net. You did that, she asked? Put that thing in the background of all those old movies? That's fucking horrible. Pardon my French. It does sell shoes, he smiled. So what do you expect to get out of this, she asked, if you can find out what's in Chombo's container? No idea, he said. None whatever. That's exactly what makes it so interesting. I don't get it, she said. Intelligence, Hollis, is advertising turned inside out. Which means, she asked. Secrets, said Big End, gesturing toward the screen, are cool. On the screen appeared their images, standing beside the table, Big End not yet seated, captured by a camera somewhere above. The Big End on the screen took a pale blue cloth from his pocket, pulled out a chair, and began to dust its arms and back and seat. Secrets, said the Big End beside her, are the very root of cool. Thank you.
So now you know it. Secrets at the very root of cool. Thank you to William Gibson. Our last writer tonight comes back to Winnipeg. He did live here and worked for a while in the Free Press, and he told me today that the worst part of his assignment, he was first assigned to the cop to do the cop report, and he never knew how to spell any of the street names. So of all the people who do no longer live in Winnipeg, he probably spells the street names here better than pretty much every one of us. It's really nice to have him back, and he's established himself as a journalist, a nonfiction writer, and a fiction writer. And this year he's actually had two published projects. One, he worked with a young writer to produce a book called The Deserter's Tale, which some of you will have encountered. And the other project is a very big, sprawling epic, which winds through Canadian history, called The Book of Negroes. Please welcome Lawrence Hill.
Thank you very much. It's fabulous to be back in Winnipeg, and thank you for inviting me back to the Winnipeg International Writers Festival. This is my third visit in 10 years, so I hope to return again. I'll have to hurry up and write another book. The Book of Negroes follows the life of an African woman in the 18th century who moves back and forth across the Atlantic Ocean. She's ripped from her homeland as a child and a slave in about 1755 as a child of 11, just entering womanhood, really. She's just entering puberty. And in all of her life, she wants to go home. She's old enough when she's stolen to know where she's coming from and where she's being stolen from. And she's young enough to guard the faint hope of maybe one day making it back home. But can you ever return home after decades of being away? The novel is really a meditation on trying to get back home and on survival of the human spirit in the face of adversity. My protagonist's name is Aminata Diallo. She's an African woman, and near the end of her life, she travels from Nova Scotia to Sierra Leone, and returning to the continent of Africa. And finally, she's brought by the abolitionists of London, England, to help advocate for the abolition of the British slave trade. So at the beginning of this novel, she's at the end of her life, beginning to recollect her life story and what becomes a fictionalized slave narrative. You can imagine Aminata as an old African woman beginning the process of recollecting, which will be the stuff of this novel. The year is 1802, and we're in London, England. I seem to have trouble dying. By all rights, I should not have lived this long, but I can still smell trouble riding on any wind, just as surely as I could tell you whether it is a stew of chicken necks or pig's feet bubbling in the iron pot on the fire. And my ears still work just as good as a hound dog's. People assume that just because you don't stand straight as a sapling, you're deaf, or that your mind is the texture of pumpkin mush. The other day, when I was being led into a meeting with a bishop, one of the society ladies told another, "We must get this woman into Parliament soon. Who knows how much longer she'll be with us?" Half bent though I was, I dug my fingers into her ribs. She let out a shriek and spun around to face me. "Careful," I told her, "I may outlast you." There must be a reason why I've lived in all these lands, survived all those water crossings, while others fell from bullets or shut their eyes and simply willed their lives to end. In the earliest days, when I was free and knew nothing other, I used to stand outside our walled compound, climb straight up the acacia tree while balancing Father's Koran on my head, sit way out on a branch and wonder how I might one day unlock all the mysteries contained in the book. Feet swinging beneath me, I would put down the book, the only one I'd seen in Bayo, and look out at the patchwork of mud walls and thatched coverings. People were always on the move, women carrying water from the river, men working iron in the fires, boys returning triumphant from the forest with snared porcupines. It's a lot of work, extracting meat from a porcupine, but if they had no other pressing chores, they would do it anyway. Removing the quills, skinning the animal, slicing out the innards, practicing with their sharp knives on the pathetic little carcasses. In those days, I felt free and happy, and the very idea of safety never intruded on my thoughts. I have escaped violent endings, even as they have surrounded me, but I never had the privilege of holding on to my children, living with them the way my own parents raised me for 10 or 11 years, until all of our lives were torn asunder. I never managed to keep my own children long, which explains why they are not here with me now, making my meals, adding straw to my bedding, bringing me a cape to hold off the cold, sitting with me by the fire with the knowledge that they had emerged from my loins and that our shared moments had grown like corn stalks in damp soil. Others take care of me now, and that's a fine thing, but it's not the same as having one's own flesh and blood to cradle one toward the grave. I long to hold my own children, and their children, if they exist, and I miss them the way I'd miss limbs from my own body. They have me exceedingly busy here in London. They say I'm to meet King George. About me, I have a clutch of abolitionists, big-whiskered, wide-bellied, bald-headed men, boycotting sugar but smelling of tobacco, and burning candle after candle as they plot deep into the night. The abolitionists say that they've brought me to England to help them change the course of history. Well, we shall see about that. But if I've lived this long, it must be for a reason. Fa means father in my language. Ba means river. It also means mother. In my early childhood, my ba was like a river, flowing on and on and on with me through the days and keeping me safe at night. Most of my lifetime has come and gone, but I still think of them as my parents, older and wiser than I, and still hear their voices, sometimes deep-chested, at other moments floating like musical notes. I imagine their hands steering me from trouble, guiding me around cooking fires and leading me to the mat in the cool shade of our home. I can still picture my father with a sharp stick over hard earth, scratching out Arabic in flowing lines and speaking of the distant Timbuktu. In private moments, when the abolitionists are not swirling about like tornadoes, seeking my presence in this deputation or my signature atop that petition, I wish my parents were still here to care for me. Isn't that strange? Here I am, a broken-down old black woman who's crossed more water than I care to remember and walked more leagues than a workhorse. And the only things I dream of are things I can't have, children and grandchildren to love and parents to care for me. The other day, they took me into a London school and had me talk to the children. One girl asked if it was true that I was the famous Mina D, the one mentioned in all the newspapers. Her parents, she said, did not believe that I could have lived in so many places. I acknowledged that I was Mina D, but that she could call me Aminata Diallo if she wanted, which was my childhood name. We worked on my first name for a while. After three tries, she got it. Aminata. Four syllables. It's really not that hard. Aminata, I told her. She said she wished I could meet her parents and her grandparents. I replied that it amazed me that she still had grandparents in her life. Loved them good, I told her, and loved them big. Loved them every day. She asked why I was so black. I asked why she was so white. She said she was born that way. Same here, I replied. I can see that you must have been quite pretty, even though you are so very dark, she said. You would be prettier if London ever got any sun, I replied. She asked what I ate. My grandfather says he bets you eat raw elephant. I told her I'd never actually taken a bite out of an elephant, but there had been times in my life when I was hungry enough to try. I chased 300 or 400 of them in my life, but never managed to get one to stop rampaging through villages and stand still long enough for me to take a good bite. She laughed and said she wanted to know what I really ate. I eat what you eat, I told her. Do you suppose I'm going to find an elephant walking about the streets of London? Sausages, eggs, mutton stew, bread, crocodiles, all those regular things. Crocodiles, she said. I told her I was just checking to see if she was listening. She said she was an excellent listener and wanted me to please tell her a ghost story. Honey, I said, my life is a ghost story. Then tell it to me, she said. As I told her, I am Aminata Diallo, daughter of Mamadou Diallo and Sira Koulibaly, born in the village of Bayo, 3 moons by foot from the grain coast in West Africa. I am a Bamana and a Fula. I am both, and will explain that later. I suspect I was born in 1745, or close to it. Let me begin with a caveat to any and all who find these pages. Do not trust large bodies of water, and do not cross them. If you, dear reader, have an African hue and find yourself led toward water with vanishing shores, seize your freedom by any means necessary, and cultivate distrust of the color pink. Pink is taken as a color of innocence, the color of childhood. But as it spills across the water in the light of the dying sun, do not fall into its pretty path. There, right underneath, lies a bottomless graveyard of children, mothers, and men. I shudder to imagine all the Africans rocking in the deep. Every time I've sailed the seas, I have the sense of gliding over the unburied. Some people call the sunset a creation of extraordinary beauty and proof of God's existence. But what benevolent force would bewitch the human spirit by choosing pink to light the path of a slave vessel? Do not be fooled by that pretty color, and do not submit to its beckoning. Once I've met with a king and told my story, I desire to be interred right here in the soil of London. Africa is my homeland, but I've weathered enough migrations for 5 lifetimes. Thank you very much, and I don't care to be moved again. Thank you.